This is tape 3 of the conversation with Judge Hasty. Continue. Does that little remark from Mr. Evers carry the conviction to you about the Mississippians?
It does. Hearing it made me think of something. I don't remember who first said it or if I ever knew who first said it. The quotation that comes to my mind, nothing that the white man can give the Negro is as important as the respect he withholds. Now, that is important, I think, both for the Negro's reaction and for the white man's reaction. The Negro's resentment of particular situations is certainly... the Negro has the feeling of being genuinely respected. Many of the demonstrations, which to some people may seem pointless or at least misdirected, I think, and here I'm playing the psychologist, are expressions of a inward urge to do something that both helps one's self-respect and wins respect from other people. So much from the Negro's point of view, and from the point of view of his white neighbor, I think that as the Negro wins the white man's respect, regardless of fondness or affection, it becomes easier for the two to deal with each other on a meaningful and constructive basis.
That is, the Negro's seeking of identity in the personal sense is also connected with his seeking of a social identity. Is that right? To put it in another language.
Well, I'm not sure which is personal identity and which is social identity. Spell out what you mean.
All right. I was thinking his sense of self-respect is
personal
identity.
Oh, yes.
Respect of others.
In many ways, they perhaps are opposite sides of a coin.
Yes, I should assume that they were. But they go together then.
I think they do. I think they do, unquestionably.
Let us take this line of speculation for a moment. Let's assume that a perfect civil rights bill has been passed.
Yes.
And is drawn and passed with teeth in it. Let's assume that fair employment practice things are in operation and are enforced.
Yes.
Let's assume that we have integration of schools as far as practical, forgetting the extreme problems, you see.
Yes.
What remains to be done, and whose responsibility is for doing some of the things that remain to be done?
Well, the basic thing that remains to be done, though this is an important step, an essential step, I think, along the way, the basic thing that remains to be done is to develop a community in which men within themselves regard race and color as a matter of no great consequence. That would be my brief answer to your question.
Now, what responsibilities would the Negro have on this, in this? Negro being that impossible abstraction.
He would have, one of his responsibilities is to seek to deal with his fellow man as individuals rather than as white men and black men, just as the white person would have the same responsibility. The Negro would have to
come out of the protective shell, habit of generations of living, which would impel him to seek in his whole range of community relationships people of the same race or color, because there's no question that even today you find many situations in which members of the white community are willing to meet Negroes more than halfway in human relationships which are genuinely ignore race, yet find Negroes not responsive to it.
How much is there a problem of what we might call de facto inferiority rather than any racial inferiority as such? How much is that problem a problem that has not been faced by and large by Negro publicists or leaders or society in general?
How much is there a problem of de facto inferiority that has not been faced?
As a responsibility of the Negro to face.
There certainly is a very real problem of developing both social attitudes, personal pride, ambition, all of those characteristics that lead an individual to make as much as he can of himself individually and as a useful member of society. There's much of that that has to be done, and of course a substantial part of the burden of that is on members of the Negro community themselves.
This goes back, I suppose, to the old split between the Booker T. Washington approach and that of Du Bois, and that whole switch from,
yes,
quote, self-improvement as a watchword,
yes,
to rights and power,
yes,
as watchwords.
Yes. It's very hard to, some of it is the hen and the egg dilemma. It is much harder to work effectively for self-improvement when all of the pressures of society, or not all the pressures, but the dominant pressures of society, are such as to convince the individual that he is not capable of very much self-improvement. So I think that Du Bois was right in recognizing that from the very beginning there had to be major emphasis on status and recognition and community acceptance, because without some substantial measure of those, the other drive doesn't go so far. Now, of course, you can, I realize people would reverse that and say that it is much easier to win acceptance if the person demonstrates that he is worthy of acceptance. And I think part of Du Bois's dealing with that was his concept of the talented tenth, and
yes,
many of those who were fighting for emancipation, the abolitionists, had the same idea that the goal can be achieved by a representative number or minority of Negroes so demonstrating their fitness for acceptance that people would come to realize that denial of acceptance should not be a racial thing.
Well, you see things like this. For instance, a speech by James Baldwin, which I heard in Washington or the Howard University nonviolence conference last fall, the lowest Negro drunkard or dope pusher has no reason to feel apologetic to any white man. Now, this is a oracular pronouncement that probably means nothing, except it has, indicates an attitude of a certain sort, you see, about the self-improvement side of things. It's denying
I understand that statement being made, but to me it's a meaningless statement. Of course he has no reason to be apologetic to any, quote, white man, unquote. But he has reason to be apologetic to himself and to society,
and more in a way to other Negroes.
Oh, of course.
Very definite reasons, you would say.
Yes.
I noticed in a speech by Dr. King more recently that he wound up with a shift to the self-improvement theme very emphatically. If you're a street sweeper, be such a street sweeper that the angels in heaven will bend over and say, "What a street sweeper we have!"
Yes.
Now this sounds like Booker T. Washington. You see, you're back to the letting down your buckets where you are.
Well, a
whole swing. You see, back through a lot of things. To that.
I'm not sure that it is, because I think
let's hear about it.
School or every leader, in one way or another, tries to build and stimulate pride in his followers.
Yes.
I don't think that is an earmark of one school rather than the other. The black Muslims, of course, pride in blackness is part of their thesis.
And self-improvement too.
And self-improvement also, yes. So I don't believe that's a distinguishing characteristic between schools. It may be that the distinction is that Booker Washington had a tendency to make that almost a whole program, as distinguished from one feature of a program having other major aspects.
There seemed to be, I don't want to speak as if I had any, I made a survey on this, but the notion of self-improvement had become almost disreputable in certain circles, because it seemed to give something away. Now, clearly,
for
propaganda
sure.
purposes anyway.
Are you speaking now of the contemporary scene, or are you speaking historically?
Well, both. Both. The emphasis was shifted very violently the other way, and I must say that my sympathy with Du Bois in this, you see. I think we have to be on that. The question is now a little different, whether the self-improvement idea has now taken on a symbolic value which is a negative, where it seems to imply time, process, delay.
It becomes a
bad word.
Yes, there has... certainly, a large part of Negro leadership is suspicious of the emphasis on self-improvement by those elements of the white community which are thought to be disposed to slow down the drive for equality. On the other hand, I suspect that it would be hard to find any significant Negro leadership which, in dealing with the members of the Negro community themselves, did not place some substantial emphasis on self-improvement.
Somewhere, or well, in fact, in the last book, James Baldwin says that the best testimony is that the Southern mob does not represent the will of the Southern majority.
It may be that it doesn't represent the way of the Southern majority in the sense of procedure, but in the sense of maintaining the status quo or preventing any major shift in racial etiquette and accommodation and so on. I wish I could feel it did not represent the will of the majority, but as of 1964, I'm afraid it does. Of course, we go back 25, 30 years and find that prevailing sentiment in the South came to disavow lynching as a horrible crime. But that did not mean that the dominant will was against keeping the Negro in his place. It was against keeping him in his place in that particularly horrible and shocking way.
What about the Northern will to keep the Negro in his place?
Well, I think unhappily there's more of that will than we sometimes like to recognize. I think I said to you earlier that the 25% vote for Governor Wallace in the Wisconsin primary, I'm afraid, truly represents at least a 25% view in your so-called liberal northern communities against some changes in the status of the Negro. For example, unsegregated or free access to residential neighborhoods and numbers of other aspects of segregation.
I read a report on the Gallup poll about Northern attitudes a few weeks ago, recent matter of months. On public accommodations, the sentiment, Northern sentiment, ran very high, say 75% in favor of, free access to public accommodations, no discrimination.
Yes, I would think it might even run higher.
Well, even higher. As given, it's run about 70, maybe 80%. It's high, anyway. Yeah. The other, they went right with it. Would you consider leaving your neighborhood if a Negro family came in? It ran almost as high. I would seriously consider leaving it, or would do so.
Well,
about 65, not quite 65.
That doesn't surprise me. In fact, if I had given detail in answer to one of your other questions as to what has to be done after there is the needed legislation, one of the basic indexes of a change of sentiment in which people don't think of race as an important thing about other people, one of the basic indexes is attitude towards living in the same immediate neighborhood with Negroes, and I have the feeling that that is the perhaps the last of the major community practices to be changed, and perhaps the most difficult to change.
Is it possible that it'll be easier to change in the South than it is in the North?
I've heard that said from time to time, there is, of course, some historic basis for it, because urban residential segregation on a broad scale is the product of your restrictive covenants and your incomparable practices in the building of this development of northern cities, largely in the period between the First and Second World War. And you have historically found during that period many southern communities in which a relatively few Negro families who were economically in the position to live in a better neighborhood or who happened to have owned property and lived for a few generations in that neighborhood lived quite peaceably there. So historically there is a northern, there was a northern development of this segregated residential pattern. Now, whether it is easier today to get persons in the South to change that pattern than in the North, in that there is some feeling of community, a greater feeling of community in southern towns than there is in northern towns, I don't know.
You find this strange thing, an extremely bright young Negro lawyer in New Orleans complaining to me that they had no ghetto. This is a political defect.
In New
Orleans. Too scattered.
They had no concentration of votes, you see. New Orleans is an atypical city because of its whole historic background of Creoles, of people of mixed blood, and even of anti-segregation legislation that was on the Louisiana statute books but ignored 30, 40 years ago.
It's true too in other southern towns to a degree. The interlocking of neighborhoods and overlapping of neighborhoods, but it's regretted by a very modern-minded young man who would like to have his ghetto as a political device in order to break the ghetto.
Yes. Well,
it gets funny, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. I think one of the very early public housing projects in the 1930s in one of the South Carolina cities, I've forgotten whether it's Charleston or Columbia, doesn't matter, but even in those early days of public housing, there were those in Washington in the national organization who were making some effort to set up public housing on a non-segregated basis. And in this particular South Carolina city, I forget which, it was finally agreed that the new housing project, which would be a long, narrow area between two paralleling streets with an alleyway running parallel to and between these streets, would be set up on this type of segregation. The houses facing on Street A would be for Negroes. The housings facing on Street B would be for whites. There would be a common alley separating them, and the people would visit over their back fences, as the case may be. But in that sense, it was just a small indication of a community desire for the status of separation, though it really was not a meaningful separation in community life.
What about the fact that there's a tradition, not a tradition, but just a fact of long standing of personal association? That never crosses the mind, I presume, of any Negro or any white man in the South as something unusual.
Yes,
the
association is entirely acceptable so long as the etiquette of the superior group and the inferior group is respected.
Now what about the reverse in the northern mores? There are no etiquettes involved, but simply a refusal of association or withdrawal from association.
Yes.
Now, if the etiquette is changed, if segregation is changed as an idea and etiquette is changed, the spade work, you might say, of the personal association, some people maintain, has already been done in the South. It never had to be undone. It was always there in some way, in all kinds of ways.
Yes.
Everything from fishing trips to bedrooms. It was just always there.
Yes. That's probably true, but it doesn't minimize the difficulty of the problem of changing the etiquette.
No. People are going to get shot over that.
Yes.
No, I didn't mean to make that easy. But I'm looking forward to another stage.
Yes.
This line of speculation is that some people hardly deny that it makes any sense at all. Some people say yes, it's a factor to be considered of importance.
Yes.
I simply wanted you, I'll read you a quote, if I may.
Sure.
We'll change the subject a little bit. The whole tendency of the Negro history movement, not as history, but as propaganda, is to encourage the average Negro to escape the realities, the actual achievements, and actual failures of the present. Although the movement consciously tends to build race pride, it may also cause Negroes unconsciously to recognize that group pride is built partly on delusion, resort to such self-deception. This is from Arnold Rose, Myrdal's collaborator.
Yes.
That's a lot to catch at one time. If you can puzzle my writing, if you wish.
No, that's
sure
all right.
You're a judge, so you can hear things.
That seems to me to presuppose a sophisticated analysis of history that is not common experience, whether one is dealing with a Negro or with any other person. I doubt whether the reading of such history has much broader consequences than the intended consequence of the referred to, namely a sense of some measure of pride rather than shame in one's race and background. I don't think that the reading of history, of such history, tends to make people believe it is unimportant to try to improve oneself, or I just doubt whether in actual experience that consequence is realized.
I would offer this as a piece of evidence.
Yes.
I would offer the evidence of Southern history, Southern official white history, where it's the Old South, you see, as offered as the official view of themselves by the white Confederate Southerners.
Yes.
And this is recognized by many, many, many people still cling to this idea, and they know it's a fraud they're practicing on themselves, and they feel sort of uncomfortable about this, and you get historians to break out of it, you see.
Yes.
But I recognize the human possibility because I've seen this thing working for white Southerners.
Perhaps this has an aspect, or what Mr. Rose wrote had an aspect that I did not grasp at the first reading of it. It may have the effect of giving an excuse for being as I am. I have been mistreated, I have been taken advantage of, and therefore the responsibility for my improvement is exclusively the responsibility of those who have mistreated me. If that is the what was meant, I certainly can see an element of truth in it. Is that the view that you think was being expressed?
Well, I think that's part of it. I think it's another part, as I make it out, again, by analogy. Or you can say, go to the extreme case, to the black Muslim history, a false history, a fabricated history, to justify pride. But it doesn't have to be that false to use history as a substitute for a present reality and to build a pride which is outside of rational justification. I think the Southern myth, the white veranda and the julep and the contented dark is plucking banjos and cavalry charges instead of the historical South, as we can find from real history. A myth, a delusion, a dream, which is used to justify some sense of superiority or defect, as you were saying.
Yes.
It can work both ways.
Yes.
It's
when
the South it works both ways. It justifies as an alibi as well as a consolation.
Well, insofar as Negro history is used to attempt to inculcate in the Negro the idea that he is a superior person rather than an inferior person, as contrasted with just another human being like other human beings, of course it's bad. I don't believe that there has been too much impact, whether it be of the Black Muslims or the Garvey movement or any of the writings of Negro history. I don't believe there's been too much impact in convincing Negroes that they are members of a superior race. Now, to the extent that there has been that effect, certainly it's unwholesome.
Excuse me. This is the end of tape 3 with Judge Hasty. See tape 4. This is the fourth and last tape of the conversation with Judge Hasty. Continue.
We can.
It doesn't matter about our voices anyway, just so we get the words in this. We're not singing. Let's see, where were we?